of many different lifestyles, of different opinions and philosophies and ways of life. Some people like to champion Buddhism as being a religion of tolerance. And in many ways, that's true. There's a particular way in which Buddhism and Buddhist practitioners are intolerant, and they're supposed to be intolerant. And so this is going to talk about intolerance today. And the particular form of intolerance that Buddhist practitioners are to have or to develop, in a sense, is intolerance to suffering. So this needs to be, of course, explained a little bit. But I chose this word, this idea of intolerance to suffering, because it's a little bit maybe provocative, a little strange idea to hear from in the context of Buddhist practice. So it makes you maybe reflect on these issues in a little bit new way. But I think it's very much so that there's the Buddha had a tremendous intolerance for suffering, and that's what motivated him to pursue his path and to find what he found out. And that in order to engage in Buddhist practice, there needs to be a healthy dose of intolerance towards suffering. It's said that it has been said that no one comes to Buddhist practice unless they suffer. Suffering is somehow some dissatisfaction, some unease, some feeling of psychological maybe discomfort with our lives, or with discomfort with the way the world is, motivates people to engage in a spiritual practice, in Buddhist practice. And the Buddha said, it's a very, very famous quote from the Buddha, where he said, "I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering." And that to me is a very powerful statement for the Buddha to have made, kind of summarizing in a sense his 45 years of teaching. So being intolerant of suffering, perhaps we can start by looking at the ways in which people are all too tolerant of their suffering. And I would argue that there's a lot of unnecessary suffering in the world, because people, all of us, I suspect you also, are all too tolerant of the suffering you have in your lives. Maybe not the big sufferings, maybe there are huge sufferings that you have that come from perhaps childhood experiences or adult experiences or whatever, that maybe you're trying to grapple with very honestly and very directly and come to terms with. But I see there's a lot of people who are all too tolerant of subtle sufferings in their life. And maybe they're addressing really the profound sufferings of their life in a responsible way. But the way they drive their cars on the freeway, the fact that they don't pay much attention to the fact that there's a subtle, perhaps, tension in their body, in their mind, in the way they drive. Maybe they're going a little bit faster than would allow for relaxed driving. And so there's a kind of tension that builds up, kind of suffering that builds up in the body, in the way they drive. And every time they drive, they're always, when they're driving, they're always thinking ahead of themselves, you know, where they have to get to. And where they have to get to is so important that the act of driving doesn't count for anything. It's just something you have to get over with. And so there's a built-in tension that comes into the system in a very, maybe subtle way. If it's in rush hour traffic, maybe it's in a big way. And I see that now all too many of us are very tolerant of that level of subtle sufferings. Or there's bigger sufferings that people tolerate. Sometimes there's sufferings in relationships, maybe family relationships, spousal relationships, that people don't really want to address. It's just that maybe they're afraid that's going to cause even greater suffering if they address the smaller suffering. So better not mention that particular issue, because that's just going to blow up in some kind of way. So we step back, we avoid it because of fear of the greater consequences. Perhaps we've had some kind of suffering that's gone on for years, and it's very uncomfortable, very painful, and we don't have the personal skills to cope with it. It just seems so overwhelming, and there can be a numbing process that goes on, where we in a sense tolerate the suffering by becoming numb to it. We shut off, we turn away from it, and this is, you know, very quite common phenomenon that not only individuals do, but societies do, neighborhoods do, families do. So the mechanism of avoidance or numbing or in the more intentional ways perhaps denying the very existence of something which is actually quite uncomfortable. We can tolerate our suffering because of perhaps a very strong ambition or desire. We really want something really powerfully. And so we feel that, well, the smaller sufferings to get that wonderful thing, we're willing to tolerate because, there's a greater good to be achieved and certain sacrifice to be made, being uncomfortable and suffering to some degree so we can get this greater good. Now, that might be, at times, a very healthy approach to life. I went to college and graduate school, and there are times where I suffered. I wasn't very happy with my situation there, and probably suffered more than I needed to, but it was an uncomfortable situation at times, but it was a greater good. It was kind of getting an education. It had its values for me. I was willing to put up with some of the discomforts that came with that. But there are times where maybe that trade-off is not really a worthwhile trade-off to live by. We have perhaps the thing we're pursuing is not really worth pursuing. Or maybe it's not really worth the trade-off we're making. Maybe a lifetime of putting up with a certain level of stress is not worth the level of financial security that stress is going to provide us with. And so we often make that kind of, I think subtly, or consciously or unconsciously, we can make that kind of calculation in our mind, a trade-off, what we're willing to put up with and tolerate because of some greater good, or some greater harm, or some greater suffering that might occur. So we tolerate our suffering, I think, partly out of ignorance. Just we don't even notice it because we're so busy charging ahead in our life. We don't notice the small sufferings or the big sufferings. We tolerate it because we're afraid of dealing with it and addressing it. So we just let's tolerate the status quo. We tolerate it so that fear is closely connected to that tolerance. We tolerate because we get numb to it. And so maybe we can't say we're tolerated exactly when you're numb to it, but there's a kind of tolerance there. We tolerate it because of our ambitions. And there's many, many, many ways which we tolerate it. And I think I ask each of you to reflect a little bit on what is your favorite or pervasive or common way in which you're suffering today. Favorite, what happened to you? What? Sorry, I hope you're okay. Is it a bicycle accident? And so each of you reflect a little bit on this kind of sufferings that you live with in your life that maybe you're quite tolerant of, and maybe you don't need to tolerate. The challenge of the Buddha was, the challenge was that we can become free of our suffering. And to really take our suffering quite seriously is a very important element of Buddhist practice. And if we tolerate it or turn away from it and ignore it, there's not only are we not really engaged in the very powerful opportunity that Buddhist practice offers, but also any turning away or ignoring suffering in many situations actually compounds the problem. I've been in situations where I've suffered, and I've wanted other people to be engaged and help me or or talk to me at least, and other people are ignoring my suffering. And it actually adds to my frustration, my difficulty, my sense of alienation when that's happened. And it can happen to ourselves. The ignoring of suffering at personal and social levels increases actually the suffering. It doesn't really make things go away. And the subtle underlying stress of ignored suffering or tolerated suffering can accumulate and create a quite powerful degree of suffering in our lives over time. The big sufferings of our life, the big conflicts and tensions and unresolved issues, the big crises and tragedies of our life that can arise, sometimes are very difficult to deal with directly. But they can be a lot easier to deal with if we have a lot of experience with dealing with the small things. Maybe you've inherited or still dealing with dramatic childhood abuse or sexual abuse or the death of someone that's very important for you. And these things are very hard to kind of deal with in a simple way. They often take a long time and serious work and reflection, and often help from other people to really come to terms with them. But they're a lot easier. But if you're putting up with all this subtle suffering in your life, putting up with the suffering of how you drive a car, or how you cook, or how you talk to your co-workers, or suffering, there's all these little small ways that we suffer that are not related to the big tragedies. But if we attend to those and take those seriously, then we're creating a field or a context of a little bit more ease, a little bit more peace, a little bit more responsibility that can make it a lot easier than to deal with the bigger difficulties when the time comes to face them. One of the very early teachings I got from my Zen training was that it's very difficult to encounter a major tragedy in your life and to deal with it if you don't have a foundation of a meditative practice behind you. What I mean by this is that if you've practiced regularly, if you have daily sitting practice, a kind of daily way of dealing with your life and responding to your life through mindfulness, and learning how to be calm and centered in the middle of great difficulty, of just your normal life, and build up the strength of that and momentum of that over time, then when the big tragedies arise, you have a really strong foundation to address that tragedy that you wouldn't have had if you didn't have that regular practice to support you. And I notice that sometimes when people come to me for counseling, sometimes people come to talk about their tragedies, and it's a lot harder for me to feel like I can really offer them much, or it's a lot harder. I can see the difference between talking to someone who comes to me completely cold without any kind of spiritual background, any practice at all, and those people who come with years of practice under their belt. So some people will put off looking honestly at their life, will put off looking at a spiritual practice until some major tragedy hits, because they're tolerating all the small, subtle sufferings of their life. And then they make it a lot harder for them when the tragedies arise. So we tolerate our suffering. Now, in being intolerant of it, what this means is we stop and look at it. Perhaps the bumper sticker for Buddhists should be, "I stop for suffering." I stop for suffering. Now, this is, of course, a pretty bad news, because it seems like a depressive thing. It's better to I go to the movies. It's better. I think I've told this a lot, but I like it a lot. The Peter's cartoon where Linus and Charlie are talking, and Charlie says something like, "Oh, so you don't think my father knows how to fix things? Well, just the other day, the car, we were driving the car, it was making some awful sound." And it says, "Oh, don't tell me he stopped and fixed it." And Charlie says, "Oh no, he just turned the radio up louder." So we stop for suffering, but not because we're morbid, but rather because we know that it's possible to live a life that's joyful and peaceful and free of that suffering. So the stopping for suffering is a step towards greater joy and happiness in our life, not a step towards increasingly being oppressed by our suffering. Now, one of the first things we do when we stop for suffering is we study it, we get to know it, we explore it, we try to investigate what's the nature of it, what's going on. And one of the first things we begin to become aware of, I hope, especially if you're instructed to do this, is to notice what is the relationship you have with your suffering. And this issue of your relationship to your experience, I think a lot of it is common sense to explore it. I think a lot of therapy, they ask you to look at that. But it's really central to Buddhist practices to study what is your relationship to whatever event you're experiencing. And in terms of your suffering, what's your relationship to it? And in the process of that, you might discover all kinds of very interesting things. You might discover the degree to which there's intolerance to it, in terms of tolerance of it, the degree to which you're kind of avoiding it or accepting it in a kind of unhealthy ways. You might also notice aversion to it. An aversion to it, when you have aversion, strong aversion to something, there's a kind of clinging and tightening around and trying to push something away in the heart or in our awareness. That is represents another form of suffering. So we might have the suffering that might arise, and then the strong aversion to it creates more suffering. So the intolerance of Buddhists, you're all supposed to become intolerant now, based on this talk, is not in any way supposed to be tinged with aversion. And maybe that's where the kind of little, why this is maybe the word intolerance is a little, hopefully a little provocative, because most people, when they hear the word intolerance, it's associated with aversion. Is that right? But actually, Buddhist intolerance has no aversion as part of it. Now, you might have aversion to your suffering, and your job then is, when you stop for suffering and pay attention to it, is to notice. Is there aversion to it? Is there unhealthy aversion to it? Is there you're adding suffering on top of it? The other thing, as part of studying your relationship to your suffering, whatever it might be, just the very fact that you're willing to investigate it changes, maybe very subtly, but changes your relationship to suffering. Many of us can get lost in our suffering, or can very strongly identify with it, or get preoccupied with it, or get into various kinds of unhealthy relationships to our suffering. The very fact that we're willing to investigate it and stop and look at it and say, what is this? Hopefully is bringing a different part of our personality or psyche to that experience that's more healthy than our being lost in it or lost in aversion to it or shutting off from it. And this movement to a different relationship is a very important contribution that Buddhist practice can make. Once you see what's going on and notice the suffering, you might notice the kind of interest you have in it, the way it functions in your life. One of the ways that suffering can function in a person's life, and one of the reasons why people can tolerate it, is that suffering can serve a purpose, a function in our lives that is unhealthy. One of the unhealthy suffering or the purposes it can have is that we can identify with that suffering, and it can be the orientation to how we present ourselves to the world. You know, if we have this feeling that, I've been... some people are genuinely victims of great suffering. But to take on the identity that I'm a victim, or I'm someone who really suffers, and embed that into who we think we are, for some people it becomes the orientation by which they present themselves to the world, by the way they want feedback from other people. They want other people to treat them in particular ways. And so that's related to how they hold that suffering. And this in Buddhism is called to identify strongly with their suffering. And so you might start, if you investigate, you might start noticing the ways in which you were using the suffering to prop up our sense of self, or prop up some self-image, or prop up some kind of way in which we want other people to respond to us. That maybe is not so healthy, and maybe not so necessary. I've known people who've realized, after doing some Buddhist practice, the degree to which they've held on to their suffering. There's a push-pull relationship to it. They very genuinely want to be free of it. But what they don't see is the way in which they're tremendously attached to it, because it gives them a sense of comfort, a sense of security, and a sense of orientation in the world. And so there's this pull-push, you know, they're kind of like this wall that they can't kind of surmount, because they want to get free of it, but they don't really want to. So as we investigate it, we might start noticing the ways in which we relate to it and some of the purposes it has that leaves us all too tolerant of it. But often our difficulty in life arises because we enter into a relationship, we latch on to and cling to, we get attached to, and we set up this strong sense of aversion to our experiences. One of the functions of meditation practice, as we become aware of our suffering and notice it, is not so much to maybe fix it or to solve it, but to help us form a radically different relationship to it. Now, in a very simplistic way, as people sit and meditate, one of the things that they're developing is their ability to get concentrated. As people get concentrated, it means that part of their psyche is being filled and being strengthened or being developed and being filled with, let's say it this way, forget that. We often concentrate in unhealthy ways on what bothers us or what we want. We latch on, get attached or something. And so we form a relationship. There's a gravitational pull. When we develop concentration on something, like as simple as the breathing, we are countering the gravitational force of our attachments with the strength of our concentration. And the stronger the concentration gets, the weaker is the pull, the weaker is the hold, the weaker is the power of our attachments. And so as we develop stronger concentration, our attachments to our particular issues and problems becomes weaker and weaker in contrast. And because of that, the concentration allows a greater sense of calm and ease, and sometimes even joy, to arise in the person. And that greater sense of calmness and the weakening sense of attachment to the issue can often change our relationship to the issue. If you're dealing with if you're standing in a very small room that's 1 square foot, just big enough for you to stand in, and the floor of that little room has a few nails sticking up, you're going to be very concerned about where you stand in that little room, because you know basically almost no place for your feet at all. But if that room gets as big as this hall here, and there's still only a couple of nails on the floor, you're going to feel a lot more comfortable about those nails being there. In the same way, we might have real issues and real that need to be addressed, but real sufferings in our life, real issues. But as our relationship to it changes, as our room in our mind and our hearts gets so big, it doesn't take away the neat nails in our hearts, but we have a very different relationship to it when there's all the space and ease. This is why some people find so much solace in going out for walks in nature, I believe. Because when you spend half a day in nature, that there's a kind of spaciousness and openness that happens in relationship to our life that sometimes can't happen when we're kind of lost at our desk at work or something. So the concentration practice in itself can begin, if you develop and strengthen your concentration practice, can develop a different relationship to your suffering. It's very hard for some people to develop concentration because they're so identified, so concerned, so preoccupied with the issues of their suffering. It's very hard to pull themselves out in order to develop through the work of concentration. But if you know that concentration has great value, maybe it can be more interesting to them to take more interest in developing your concentration. It's very wonderful that the kind of sense of presence that can arise in a concentrated state. I read recently, I think I mentioned this on Monday night, someone was writing, I don't know if the person was even Buddhist, but the person was distinguishing in his or her mind the difference between therapy and spirituality, psychotherapy and spirituality, which is a dangerous thing to differentiate because there's so much overlap. And they complement each other so well. But in this person's mind, the distinction was, and the distinction is way more important here, not the comparison, is one focuses on fixing a problem so the person can become whole. In this person's analysis, understanding, spirituality helps a person understand their whole without having to fix the problem. There's a sense of presence that can arise when we understand that we can be complete, a kind of sense of wholeness that doesn't require us to fix our foibles or our shortcomings. And this is a great relief because I believe it's probably impossible for us to fix all our foibles and shortcomings in one lifetime or in any lifetime. Human beings are to some degree limited. It doesn't mean that we're supposed to not try to address some particular issues. We are supposed to address particular issues that cause a lot of suffering. But it can be very much easier to address those issues if we have this much larger sense of presence or wholeness or sense of completion, that can come from a very simple thing of developing concentration, if that's accessible to you. I talked to a lot of psychotherapists over the years who've worked with Buddhist practitioners or meditators. And the common observation they make is the difference between the meditating clients and non-meditating clients is, they're very similar. So they come with the same problems. So that's nice. But what they say the difference is that people who come with a meditation background are much less defensive about their issues. So it's much easier to address them and talk about them much more quickly than people who don't have meditative practice, where often it might take many weeks or months of developing trust between the therapist and the client before the therapist is willing to reveal themselves. So we investigate and look at our suffering, and we see our relationship to it in an honest way. And then we see maybe it's possible to develop a different relationship to it, one that doesn't have aversion to it, maybe one that has kindness to it, gentleness to it, one that has a lot of compassion to its presence. We see that it's possible maybe to develop a different relationship to it, to weaken the great pull of the way we relate to it. There's two things, right? There's how we relate to an issue, and then there's a strength of the way that attachment is held in us. And the concentration practice can help us not necessarily change the relationship we have, but can change the strong pull, or strong energy that is channeled into that relationship. Does that make sense? But mindfulness practice is a lot more than concentration. And one thing that mindfulness helps us do is to help develop and strengthen our ability to be very honest, to look very honestly. Part of the reason we stop for suffering is so we can look very honestly at the roots of it, the causes of it. What are the sources of it in our lives? And it sometimes takes a lot of careful mindfulness to really look honestly at what is the source of our suffering. Someone, for example, can be dealing for years with a particular form of suffering and looking at the wrong place to solve it. They can maybe the place to really solve that particular suffering is not in the history of what happened in the past, but rather at some point it might be the way in which them holding on to that suffering is functioning nowadays, right now. It might be, as I said earlier, which happens occasionally, that someone is depending on their suffering to give them a sense of security or orientation or get certain kind of feedback from the people around them. And that's where they needed to look, not in the history of the past. So mindfulness helps us to look very honestly at our relationship, at what's going on, and we start seeing the roots in the present moment. The strength of Buddhist practice in that it focuses on the present moment and what happens in the present moment. It shows us, it's supposed to show us, how where the roots of our suffering are occurring in the present moment. The conditions that gave birth to it might be in the past. Understanding the past conditions might be helpful, very helpful. But the roots of it, what's actually occurring, how suffering is actually being made in the present, is happening in the present. And this is a phenomenal challenge, which is not easy to understand, the way in which our suffering is born moment to moment. And the strength of mindfulness, as it really gets concentrated, is to see the moment to moment birth, the moment to moment attachment and clinging, which gives birth to our suffering. Moment-to-moment choices we make. And it's very hard to see the moment-to-moment choices we make unless the mind is very, very still and concentrated. And in a sense, we don't have those choices. If we don't see that we have a choice, we don't have choice. So But one of the amazing things to discover as you do intensive meditation practice is you see the degree, phenomenal subtle degree, in which we live in a world of choice that's invisible to us in the kind of normal street consciousness that we're on. So the idea is to become very intolerant of yourself. I think you'd make me very happy if you became the way I'm talking about today, if you became really intolerant, and especially of the small sufferings, because that's where I see a lot of people are all too tolerant. But in becoming intolerant of it, then to do all the do these things I'm talking about, to bring your practice to bear on it, not to accept it as if this is a done deal and things have to always be this way. And then in becoming intolerant of suffering, I hope at the same time you become phenomenally and greatly tolerant of your joy. There are some people who overlook their joy and don't, some people, kind of for the same reason that they cling to suffering, sometimes have aversion to joy, or sometimes there's a few. I remember one woman who came to me many years ago who was beginning to feel some joy in her meditation practice, which periodically can happen. And she came from a particular religious background where joy was a spiritual no-no. And she felt too guilty and felt there was something wrong with her to feel this joy, especially since it's kind of often a physical joy that arises in meditation. And I felt it was a great privilege to just kind of look the person in the eye and say, it's okay to feel joy. So to become much more tolerant of our joys, and maybe the same principle applies, to become tolerant and to notice and to stop for the small joys of our life. Sometimes we can overlook that there's a lot of small little joys in our lives that go overlooked because we're so barreling ahead into the future, or are ahead of ourselves in various ways, or are preoccupied with the bigger issues, or that are not really in the present moment, but they're mostly in our hopes and our aspirations. So to become more tolerant, to notice more our joys, to appreciate them more as they arise, and to be with them. Joy, the ability to appreciate life, strengthens to the degree to which we do it. And use it or lose it is a saying, right? So if you don't use your ability to appreciate the small joys of life, maybe you won't notice the big ones when they arrive. So what are your joys in your life? What are the small joys you can appreciate more? Maybe you can even begin to appreciate and find some joy in your suffering. Not in the suffering itself, but in the joy of being engaged in them, the joy of bringing your practice to bear on them, the joy of there's a kind of joy that comes with engagement. And there can be joy in addressing our suffering. Oh yeah, I can do this. This is something I can negotiate. This is something I can bring myself to and try to clarify and maybe see through to the other end. So, for the sake of everyone's joy, may all of you become greatly intolerant. Any questions or concerns you want to raise? Objections? Yes? So, acute grief. I think, so the first thing we do is we stop for it, in the sense of, not so much, we stop for it, kind of notice it, okay, here it is. And because people can run away from it in various ways. People can want to avoid it. People can have all kinds of relationships to that grief that make it difficult for grief to be there in a honest and complete way. So we start to notice what the relationship is to it, or what are other people telling you should be your relationship to it. It's very common with grief that people, other people after some months or a while say, aren't you old? You should be over with by now. And there's no should be in grief. Different people's griefs have different lifetimes, different ways of passing through a person. So if we take on other people's ideas, other people's discomfort with us feeling our grief, and saying you should be over it, then it just adds to the suffering. Grief, as we stop and look at grief, and if we look at grief very honestly, some people find that it's made up of many different elements. It isn't just one single thing. It might be, at the core of it might be a sense of pain or a loss. But sometimes there can be fear of the future, how am I going to manage now? There can be a sense of shame or embarrassment or guilt, you know, maybe I should have done better. There can be many kind of other kind of ideas and judgments that get tied into the initial pain of loss that make the whole thing much more complicated. And so the mindfulness practice can help us to look at it much more honestly. What are we actually doing? How much of all these different elements that we bring to the grief are necessary and how much are not necessary? And in doing that, free our grief, so our grief is not held back. If we're no longer embarrassed about our grief, we're no longer stuck in our guilt or in our anger, but then the grief can actually move through us much more freely. And part of the function of, mindfulness practice is to help these kinds of things to move through us much more freely. Even though in doing that, they might become more intense. But in becoming more intense, they actually often become freer, and they become less of a big deal. I told the story of this woman, a friend of mine, who had, three important people in her life died in 1 year. Her brother, her father, close friend. And she went on retreat, a 10-day retreat. At the end of the retreat, she said, the difference between her grieving process at home and on retreat was that at home, she'd have waves of grief that go through her, and they would take hours. And then on a retreat, the waves would come through her, they were much more intense, but they'd last for minutes. And part of the reason was at home, there were all these things she had to do, and she was engaged with. She wasn't just being with her grief 100%. Whereas in retreat, she can do that. And also on retreat, she had the idea that she was giving permission to the feeling just to arise and to pass without any distractions. And so they would pass much through much quicker. And then there'd be great periods of peace, and then the next wave would come. And so she developed a much kind of easier relationship to her grief when she knew there would just kind of be these waves passing through. Is this addressing your concerns? Support each other. I don't know if someone came to me with asking about their grief, I doubt that I would tell them, oh, you should go get concentrated. But if that person had developed concentration before the loss had occurred, and had that as under the belt, a very strong muscle of concentration, then there's a level of calm that they might be able to bring to that grief, and it helps them see it much more clearly, and gives more freedom for the grief to pass through. They're less likely. There can be a strong gravitational pull to the grief in the way we latch on because of our attachment or our fear or whatever. And that's the issues are stay the same, but the power of our attachment to a particular issue can be less if we have a strong ability to get concentrated. Like you're living in a bigger room. Right. Yeah. So hopefully we see how we're maybe taking on other people's shoulds and freeing ourselves from it. And okay, well, that's their problem. You know, I'm just going to let my process. Yes, please. Exactly, that's very common experience. But then the analysis, the study of that situation has to be a little carefully done. Because there are situations where maybe a little bit of hurt is actually for their greater good. And so you see the possibility that being really honest with someone and having them deal honestly with it might cause them some pain. But unless they deal very honestly with what's going on, they're just going to continue wallowing, or not wallowing, they're going to continue in this difficult situation for the whole life. Or perhaps you, I don't know, you know, a person, you might be, don't want to hurt someone, but you are then living with a certain level of pain that might continue for a whole lifetime. They're just... So if we talk kindly and honestly about what needs to be talked about, then we shouldn't be too afraid of the hurt that someone might feel if it's necessary, if we do it kindly, and if it's honest. If it's not necessary, we can't do it kindly, and it's not honest, maybe we're better off not saying anything. But that trade-off is one that shouldn't be done naively. Flip that carefully. Yes. Well, I hope not. Mindfulness is self-correcting. So if there's an apathy like that, actually it would be understood as being a form of aversion and kind of shutting down, lack of aliveness. I think that when we're tolerant of suffering, we actually lose our aliveness. As we wake up to it more and study it and get to know it, we discover wellsprings of vitality we didn't know before. But it might be in the context of being a little bit more calm than we usually are. But calmness and apathy are not the same thing in any kind of way. But one of the interesting things that I see in the many people is that people want to feel alive and feel certain passion because it gives them a sense of energy, of purpose, all kinds of things. And so people will fuel themselves, fuel that passion from unhealthy sources. So for example, there are some people in our culture, a few people, for whom don't have a natural sense of their own vitality and aliveness and will depend on anger to get to fully be charged. And there's a passion of anger that really brings them joy because they don't know how to be alive, motivated without that anger. Or people who go to, you know, horror movies or something for the same purposes. Or people for whom great ambition and greed gives them a lot of energy. And they feel a lot of passion for the energy. But they might actually, if they quieted down and didn't use desire or aversion as the caffeines of the soul, they might have to go through a period of withdrawal, which kind of disoriented for a while, just like it is from caffeine, you withdraw from it. But once the caffeine of the soul wears off, then the soul's or our inner natural vitality and aliveness and passion has a much greater chance to show itself. In relationship to suffering itself, which is kind of just a kind of a buzzword or a kind of keyword, category word for a whole umbrella word for a whole bunch of other things. In the Buddhist teachings, there are two forms of passion that can arise out of honestly confronting our suffering. One is the passion of compassion. And a tremendous motivation can arise out of compassion. And we can do a lot in the world, be fueled to do a lot out of compassion. Maybe much more efficiently, effectively, than if we fueled by aversion. And the other is passion is called samvega, which is a passion for practice. That our contact, we meet suffering. We say, oh, I'm really going to address this. I'm really going to practice with this. This is going to really, it inspires me to try to come to terms with this, try to find the freedom from suffering, the end of suffering. And so the contact with suffering can give birth in a healthy psyche to a powerful motivation to practice, passion for it. And when we avoid suffering or deny it, turn away from it, we shortchange ourselves from those two passions. The Buddhist practice, when done, I think, in a healthy way, comes with actually a fair amount of passion, zeal, enthusiasm. So I hope it doesn't lead to apathy or indifference or aloofness. But it is sometimes something that happens to people when they do practice. It is something you should be on the lookout for. But if you look at it very honestly, we don't see it. Honestly, then that possibility of that motivation is lost to us. So sometimes the most valuable thing to do in practice is not to address immediately the suffering in the world, but to address what that does to us, the relationship we have and the suffering we have in relationship to it. And hopefully, ideally, you know, if we want to address the suffering in the world, hopefully we're not suffering because of it. You know, we're at peace with it, in a sense. And because we're at peace with it, in a sense, there's possibility of this real clear, motivated compassion to do something about it. Well, thank you for listening to suffering. Not that many people who in the world who'd be content to sit here and listening on and on about suffering. I don't know, maybe some of you weren't content, but you stayed anyway. So may you all become intolerant in this very particular way. From which to see the concepts and ideas which kind of are there kind of regularly is from having an experience of the unconditioned, which is having kind of like having an experience of awareness or consciousness that has been purified of all the different concepts and all the different conditioning that's part of it. And like having experience of the water coming out clear. From that vantage point, we'll see if. I wanted to talk about a vision. Martin Luther King's famous speech, you know, I have a dream. With the depth of Buddhist practice, there is a kind of revisioning or new vision that people have of the world. And one of the new visions, one of the new understandings, is the degree in which concepts and ideas are a huge part of our life and our experience. But we see how they start getting into, how they come into play, and how we can pick them up and drop them. We don't have to drive on the right side of the street. But also, more importantly, the experience of the unconditioned, the vision that gets born of that, is a vision of an understanding of the phenomenal degree in which human beings suffer in this planet, in this world. It's not really possible for us to understand how much suffering there is in the world unless we really understand our own mind deeply and how much suffering is in our own mind. And we really understand the depth of suffering in the human mind, it blows you away how much suffering there's in the world. It isn't just simply suffering of hunger and homeless, but even the people who, you know, have most of the things they need suffer dramatically. And it's a phenomenal vision of the degree to which the world is suffering, and at the same time, this phenomenal vision of the possibility of peace, and the vantage point in the sense of the unconditioned.
is that place, when consciousness is not colored or influenced or flavored by anything, we can see then the world in a way that's, I believe, much more thorough than is possible without that vantage point. And the immensity of suffering is just astounding. And the immensity of peace is also as astounding. So anyway, yes?
I just want to clarify, I understand the part very clearly about pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. You know, I'm assuming that, imagining that, back to your example of the tap with the different colors of water, that, you know, it's not pleasant, it's not unpleasant, it's not even neutral.
Right.
And it's just there.
Right.
I just needed to kind of see how that related to the other things you were talking about.
The unconditioned is neither pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral.
Okay.
Anyway, I'm sorry to go over, and I'm sorry if I confused you today, or said anything. One of the nice things, I think Ajahn Amaro says this, which I think is very nice, is that if there's anything I've said today which is not useful, leave it here. Thank you all.